It seems that often when you begin your storytelling process, you do begin with the I, we, and it
right.
lens. And can we just start there?
Sure.
Why is that a place where you naturally go? And can we really condense the most important pronouns or perspectives into these three? Are there really no other ones we should consider?
Yeah, there are lots of other pronouns, and I'm in favor of all of them.
All pronouns.
Yes,
I
want to go on record as being in favor of all pronouns. I do but not marginalize pronouns.
Okay,
this
would
be a very horrible thing. One of the things that happens is, you know, you're doing this sort of cross-cultural sweep. You're kind of looking at all these different world philosophies, psychologies, spiritual systems, and you're looking for common patterns. So you can sort of say, you know, these things appear to be really important. We should pay attention to them. One of the earliest common sort of classifying systems that you find, and a lot of people are familiar with it, is certainly you find it in Plato, for example, is the idea of the good, the true, and the beautiful. And that's really, if you think about those words, actually very interesting, because the good, the true, and the beautiful, I mean, they all sort of sound important, but if you kind of think into them, they're also a little bit different. And so the question is, why are these three different things? For example, why doesn't truth cover goodness and beauty? And the more you sort of start thinking about these three things, the more interesting it gets. And you find them in Eastern cultures, Western cultures. It's pretty common. And actually right up to, just to give a really technical example, Immanuel Kant, who many people think is the world's greatest philosopher, wrote three great critiques. And those were critiques about the good, the true, and the beautiful. So even down to very, very modern, sophisticated times, these three domains keep appearing everywhere. So all of a sudden you say, well, if I'm going to have some sort of comprehensive map, I might want to pay attention to these things. A common distinction is art, morals, and science. Art represents the beautiful. Morals represents the good. And science represents true, objective truth. That's one way of looking at what these sort of three domains are. The good means morals, ethics, how we should treat each other as human beings. The beautiful has to do with aesthetics, self-expression, art, artistic expression. And truth can have many meanings, but it tends to mean something is sort of objectively true or not. So if I say it's raining outside, is that true or false? Well, you go to the window, you look, if it's raining, you say it's true, it's raining. But then that doesn't really tell us if rain is beautiful or not. That's a different question. I happen to think it's beautiful. Most people do. And then nor is that sort of how should I morally act if somebody's out there getting wet and doesn't want to get wet. That's not answered by truth. That's morals. So all of a sudden you sort of find that there's three domains in human life. And one has to do with sort of what's objectively true. One has to do with what's beautiful or self-expressive and so on. That doesn't necessarily have to be true. I mean, what's true, what's beautiful for some people doesn't necessarily have, it's not something you can give a scientific test for. And then there's how we treat each other as sentient beings, human beings, what's the right thing to do? Those distinctions turn out to be important because different types of human inquiry are built around them. There's entire branches of human endeavor break down into these three categories. What's called validity claims, how you tell what's right in these areas are all quite different. And they also play, obviously, a very important role in your own everyday life. Because really, you're confronted by these kinds of questions and decisions all the time. And the way you can see it most easily is that it shows up in these pronouns, first, second, and third person pronouns. So, and there are many variations on first, second, and third person pronouns. We can talk about those, but a simplified form is I, we, and it. And let me just preface it by saying, technically, first person means the person who is speaking. So right now, I, that pronoun, would be I'm the one speaking. Second person is the person being spoken to, and that usually means you. So you is a classic second person pronoun. And third person means the person or thing being spoken about. So that's a he, a him, a her, or an it, or a they, or a them. If you and I are talking, that's first and second person, then there's an implicit understanding that you and I, to some degree, understand each other. So we're part of a we, and we actually use that term. We say we understand each other. We technically is first person plural, but we use it for second person also because you implies we. Now, after that thoroughly confusing statement, let me just then move into I, we, and it as examples of what we're going to use as first, second, and third person. I is art. It's self and self-expression. We is morals, how we treat each other, and it is objective truth. So I, we, and it boils down to variations on the good, the true, and the beautiful. Every time people use I and we and it, they're engaged in these kinds of domains. And they're making decisions about what I should do, what I shouldn't do, what's true, what isn't true, what's self-expressive, what isn't, what's beautiful, what isn't, and so on. What's desirable, what isn't, what do I desire, what do I want, what do I need. So one of the things that we try to do in just using I, we, and it is point out that any occasion can be looked at from those three different perspectives. And that's important because in the world where science dominates, for example, science tries to reduce everything to an it, an objective it. Science, real materialistic science, doesn't believe there's consciousness or beauty or art or morals in the world. There's nothing but objects, its, atoms, dust, dirt, rocks, that's it. And so scientific materialism, as we call it, is the reduction of all interior states of beauty and goodness, transcendence, spirit, and so on, to a world of its. Nothing but objective, flat its running around out there in the world. Obviously, that's probably not a good thing to do. And it's not to say that its aren't there, that objective truth isn't there. It is. But there's also the I and the we components. And those can't be reduced to it. And there's goodness and beauty and the sublime and transcendence and ecstasy and all of that. And that's just as real as its. If you believe that you have to include the good, the true, and the beautiful in a comprehensive map. Now, if you don't, then you're going to try to reduce one of those three to the other one. And incidentally, it's gone other ways as well. Subjective idealists try to reduce everything to I. And the postmodernists try to reduce everything to we. Everything is a social construction of the we. I think all three of those reductionisms are wrong because all three of them try to exclude these other domains. So they're not following the rule, everybody's right. They're trying to carve out other people, and that's not nice.
Let's just go back a couple steps here, because I know you don't want to marginalize any pronouns, and neither do I. Neither do I. So you somewhere got left out for me. We crossed. You became part of the we. And what happened to you?
The interesting question about you, second person. Right now, I'm talking to you. The question is whether you and I understand each other, because if you and I don't understand each other at all. And it could be for any number of reasons. You could be in a coma.
You could be incomprehensible.
I could be incomprehensible.
It's possible.
That's possible. If you and I are not part of a we, so that we understand each other when we say that, then you're really a third person to me. You might as well be an it or a him or her, because we're not communicating at all. So even though you, it's very important that you is second person, and that is a distinct pronoun. And there's also second person plural. This first person singular is I. First person plural is we. Third person singular is him or her or it. And third person plural is they or them or its. Second person is interesting. Second person singular is you. But English doesn't have a good word for second person plural. So Southerners have to say y'all, you all. And Northerners say you guys. They're trying to somehow indicate, you know, the second person plural. But what's really important in all of that is that if you and I understand each other, then I and you are part of a we. Is that part?
Yeah, and if we don't understand each other, I'm an it.
You might as well be an it or a him or her. Okay. There's no communication at all. So we don't want to ignore you. But you is important. I sometimes use second person as you slash we. Because what's really implied in you is that there's an understanding. You and I are talking. Right now, I'm first person, and you're second person. And then when you talk, you're first person, and I'm second person. So we have two I's have become part of a we. And we actually use that. We say, do we understand each other? Yes, we understand each other. And so that's what's really important. That's the sort of crucial component, is whether the you is part of a we or not. And then it falls on the first person plural side or the third person object alien it side. And so that's why we kind of tend to talk about I, we, and it. You works fine, We can say I, you, and it, because the you implies this interpersonal domain. But we sometimes just shorten it to I, we, and it.
Okay, that's helpful. And then my other question here had to do with the validity claims and how they're different for the I, we, and it realms. So it's pretty obvious in the it realms, you can test it, it's raining, it's not raining, that makes sense. So what are the validity claims for the I and the we realms? How do I know if something's beautiful or not beautiful or moral or not moral?
Right. Again, to kind of show how these simple distinctions that are in all natural languages, the I, we, and it, they show up in these sort of everyday interactions because we use those words all the time, but then they also show up in very complex philosophical arguments. We talked about Immanuel Kant, we've talked about Plato, the good, the true, and the beautiful. Probably the world's greatest living philosopher is a German gentleman named Jürgen Habermas. And Habermas actually has what he calls three validity claims. And these are very complex. You kind of look at them and you go, woof. I mean, this is tough. Well, any German whose last name begins with an H is going to be a bitch. I mean, it's you just Heidegger, Hegel, Husserl, Horkheimer, Habermas. There's some club over there that's some really horrifying Teutonic thing going on over there. Habermas is one of those, but he's also brilliant. And he's certainly my favorite orthodox, if I can say that, philosopher, conventional philosopher. And his validity claims, they sound kind of far out, but he calls them for truth, for truthfulness, and for justness or appropriateness. And those really are it, I, and we, those in the order that I gave them. So truth is, as you were saying, you just talked about, objective truth is what it's generally taken to mean. So we say it's true that it's raining, or is it true that hydrogen, you know, weighs so many micro ounces? Is it true that water is two hydrogen atoms and one oxygen atom? All of that. That's fairly well understood. It usually means some objective event that you can go and actually check yourself. Truthfulness is interesting because it's the validity claim for the I domain. And what that really means is you and I right now are talking, and you're first person I, and I'm a first person I. Now, objective truth, we can both sort of, you know, I say that table is over there. Is that true? We can kind of look at that. But if you want to know the validity claim for what's going on inside my eye, I have to tell you what's going on inside my eye, and you have to decide whether I'm lying or not. So the truthfulness means how much you can count on me for me to tell you the truth about what's going on inside of me. It's also called sincerity or integrity. And that's what we try to judge when we interact with another I, don't we? You meet a person, and objectively, okay, they're 5'8", and they weigh this much, and they're all that, and I'm fine. But I want to know, are they being truthful when we're in this conversation? Because that's the only way I can start to trust them. And that's the only way I can establish that when they report their inner territory, they're not lying. So truthfulness becomes the validity claim for that domain. And that's sort of what Habermas is saying. And it sort of jives. I mean, once you think about it, it sort of makes a certain kind of sense that that's the only way we have to get at each other's interiors is when I tell you what's going on. Then you have to interpret it. You have to decide whether I'm telling the truth or not. It gets a little bit more interesting because if you actually look at psychotherapy, what happens to people, if we can take a Freudian view or a Gestalt view or any sort of depth psychology view, is that there are parts of yourself that you're not truthful about. So because you're not being truthful about these parts of yourself, they're kind of shadow elements. You try to hide them. You try to deny them. You lie about them. That's the validity claim. You're not being truthful with yourself this time. And when you're untruthful about parts of yourself, those parts show up as symptoms, as neurosis, as pain, as anxiety, as depression. So you violated that validity claim. You're not being truthful about your own heart and soul and mind. So it's not just some abstract philosophical thing. It's how we lie to ourselves all the time because we're violating that validity claim. Does that make sense?
A person in their most beautiful sense is being completely truthful?
Truthfulness.
Truthfulness.
Now, beauty is, we'll get to that, and that's a sort of a subset of this. And beauty is a part of the broader domain of aesthetics, what's aesthetically pleasing. And so that really also relates to self and self-expression, and that relates to truthfulness. So beauty can have, you know, many kind of different meanings, very technical meanings. And so we have to be a little bit careful about that, because that can vary a little bit. But what underlies the notion of aesthetics, when it relies to the, on the self, is how you are self-expressing yourself sincerely or authentically or with integrity. And so great artists have a self-expressive truth capacity. They can express and convey these aesthetic realms with great force. And that's again, part of that I-ness, whether they're expressing the self with a certain power, richness, authenticity, and so on. Beauty is a kind of a subset of that, and it falls into the general realm of it. And beauty is a kind of a, you know, a little bit slippery. That can change from culture to culture as well. But the basic I is there in all cultures, it's in all major languages, and the whole notion of truthfulness about the I is really important. And it's really important in pathology, because it's the easiest way to explain what happens with psychopathology or with neurosis. You're not telling the truth about yourself. You're not being truthful. So you have to hire somebody to hold your hand and walk you through your own interiors and so you don't lie about them. And that's really what happens with psychotherapy.
Okay, and then the validity claim for the realm of morality?
For ethics, is justness, appropriateness. This is Habermas's term for that. And all it's really talking about is in any society of human beings, we have various rules for how we treat each other, and that's ethics and morals. And that can't be reduced to just what is or truth. Like we say, if it's raining outside, I say that's true, but that doesn't tell me what I should do about it. So there is a distinction between what is and what should be done. And that's the difference between it and how we treat we. And that can't really be derived from just the I either, because the whole point about a we is that there's more than one I. And that gets very, very complicated. I mean, a we slash you is the great, great mystery. It's much more mysterious than an I or an it, because those are sort of lying around on their own, you know. But when you and I say we understand each other, that's astonishing, truly astonishing. That's the mother of all miracles. And they're all sort of, you sort of get into the whole discussion about why that could happen.
And when does it happen? How do you know?
And when,
yeah.
And when does it happen? And mostly it doesn't happen. But it's astonishing when every now and then people say, you know, I know what you mean, I understand you. And there's a meeting of minds. And a lot of really great philosophers believe that the reason that can happen is that ultimately there's one self, capital S. And that's why we can resonate with each other and actually feel that there's a connection, which would be very hard to do if we're just kind of running around as separate little lumps of stuff bumping into each other. That's another part of the story. So we started with sort of very sort of complex good, the true, and the beautiful, and all of that, and really saw that these things are embedded in everyday language as I, we, and it. And every time you're using those terms, or any of those others, he, them, they, etc., you're really engaging these different dimensions of human existence. And so what we try to say with an integral approach is that however you want to get into the fine details about this, don't try to reduce the good or the beautiful to the true, or don't try to reduce I and we to it, or vice versa. In other words, everybody's right. All of these domains are very real and very important. So if you're going to come up with a comprehensive map, the suggestion is one of the first things you do is have the good, the true, and the beautiful allowed, or I, we, and it, or first, second, and third person pronouns, or these different validity claims that Habermas has used. So anytime we go into a situation and we're looking at a human potential or yoga or education or politics, if you're using an integral approach, you'll say, what does the situation look like from an I perspective? What does it look like from a we perspective? And what does it look like from an it perspective? So that's sort of one of the ways that we'll start to try to flesh out any approach to make sure we're not leaving out these other dimensions. Because too many people have felt there's a great deal of validity to all three of these dimensions, and therefore part of an integral approach is let's include that. Until somebody gives us really, really convincing evidence not to do it, which nobody really has done.